we don't have to be alone in our sexual search for who we are and what we feel good about.
Hi, welcome to Resonate, Conversations and Life Lessons from Rancho La Puerta. I'm your host, Barry. Today, my guest is Dr. Pepper Schwartz. She is a sociologist and a sexologist, a title she's very proud of. Pepper has a career that has spanned over 50 years. She has written 26 books. She is the first sex and relationship advisor for AARP, and she is a sought-after presenter around the globe and has presented here at Rancho La Puerta. She is also one of the relationship advisors for the TV show called Married at First Sight, now in its 19th season. Not only does she conduct research, she has access to a lot of research. And what's even more important, she has 50 years of experience with actual people. And she realizes people's views and beliefs about sex and relationships are very different. I welcome this opportunity to talk to Pepper today. Hey, Pepper, welcome to Resonate. I certainly have been looking forward to our conversation.
Me too. I truly always enjoy talking to you.
So I noticed that you are, you have a PhD, is it in sociology?
Correct.
And then you also have the title as a sexologist. And how does one get that title? How can I get that title?
Well, in your own very unique way, I think you already have it. I think everybody at Bingo would acknowledge that. But it's writing books, doing research, getting federal grants to study things that have to do with sexuality. Probably at some point put my name together with sexology, and I'm pretty proud of that.
No, I think it's wonderful. There's not a lot of you out there, I wouldn't imagine.
Well, we're trying to grow a few new ones.
Were you always interested in studying relationships and sexuality, or when did that happen for you?
Age 11.
Age 11? Wow, you actually remember.
I swear this is a true story. Girlfriend ran over to my house and crying at 11. Their mother had caught her, quote unquote, touching herself down there and told her she was evil and going to hell. And my mother had given me a little sex ed book, put it in the linen closet. So I told her she wasn't going to hell. She was going to the linen closet. And I was going to show her this little, sort of sperm and eggs book. And then I said to my mother, that comforted my girlfriend, Franny. She felt okay. She wasn't going to die. And and then I said, Mom, we've saved Franny. We could save others. And my mother called together a little sex education group in 1956, and we talked about sex. And I don't think that was, I didn't know it was going to be a life choice, but it was me feeling that there were things to learn about sexuality that were important to people's health and welfare.
I would think that it sounds to me like your mom was pretty progressive for 1956.
Well, she was. I mean, she was an unusual and wonderful woman.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. So, what was the first book that, like in the 70s and the 80s that really kind of gave you a title as someone? Cause I read that it was the book that you wrote about, American Couples.
Yeah, that was a big book, American Couples, Money, Work, and Sex. It was a study of 12,000 people across the United States, and we compared heterosexual married people, heterosexual cohabiting people with gay couples and lesbian couples who were in committed relationships. And we compared all of those kinds of couples in terms of, what they did in terms of daily life, work, not just sexuality, but also to what extent the needs for intimacy and for maintaining a relationship were similar or different.
Yeah. So did you find resistance to, I feel like talking about sex probably in the 50s and 60s was a little taboo, or maybe in the 50s for sure, but did it get easier?
Well, yes and no. It sort of undulates in terms of acceptance and non-acceptance, but we did get denounced on the floor of Congress by some Southern senator for getting money. We had called the study, the management of conjugal and quasi-conjugal diets, trying to make it as scientific as possible. And the senator realized that the National Institute of Mental Health had funded our study and that there were gay people in it. And then he, you know, talked about the destruction of society. But so, you know, that was in the 80s. I mean, much less earlier. Yes, I think we have more discussion, more open acknowledgement of sexual diversity and, you know, people's personhood being part of their sexuality, not all of it. You know, has it progressed for sure? Is it where I would expect it to be in terms of not just issues about people who are gay or straight or whatever, but just understanding, accepting, and releasing our own sexual tastes, interests, and self-identity? No, it's not where I think it should be.
Right. So have you seen views of the American people change? Your career is 50 plus years now. So have you seen, what changes have you seen in that time?
Well, I've seen more acceptance of other sexual selves, like gay people, lesbians, trans people. I mean, there's certainly a lot of prejudice left, but it's much better than it was. People can say who they are and not be afraid, at least in most, but not all cities in these countries that are contiguous in North America. It gets pretty dicey still in any parts of the Middle East and in various other, right, you know, much more conservative countries. But in general, I think we know more. We can go to mass media. I mean, people always think about sex on media and they think of pornography, but no, there's also a lot of really great chats, information, therapy available. I mean, we don't have to be alone in our sexual search for who we are and what we feel good about.
Do you think it's accepted now that sexual behavior is part of the human condition and it's fundamental?
That's a great question, Barry. I think the former is somewhat true and the latter still seems to be something I need a mission for, because I don't think people understand how important it is. They want to put it in some little black box as part of something, you know, you visit at night, but it's a part of our being. It's really important. As an older person, I have a new mission, which is that, you know, there's no expiration date on your sexuality until you expire. I don't want people to think that there's something funny or cute or wrong about sexuality at each age of who we are and how we interpret it to ourselves and how we practice it.
Right. Well, I mean, I think maybe I heard you say this in a lecture one time, or maybe, and I'm sure I've read this lots of places, that there's a lot of sex happening at the retirement homes. So that's a positive thing to me.
It is a positive thing, very much to me. I'm like, you know, I just turned 80, you know. It's insane. You know?
Well,
but I want that as part of myself. I want that respected and noticed as part of me. I didn't turn that faucet off. I direct it to my guy, but, you know, I'm just saying, I don't want to be neutered because I'm older. And I think that the sexuality is a lifelong issue.
Do you think cultural expectations around sexuality differ from what actual research shows? And do you see differences in that?
Well, research doesn't cover everything. And often we have one or two studies on something. I'm a big fan of replication. I think it's hard to get real information from people when they're embarrassed. It's important to have a lot of things that are anonymous. But I'll give you an example where I think there's a difference in, or maybe even a lack of research. I think sexual fantasy is not PC. What people actually think about in their heads to turn themselves on or find exciting, most of us wouldn't say even to our nearest and dearest because, you know, some of it's kinky, some of it's dark, some of it's a fantasy that works. And we know in our heads, but we don't want it in real life, you know? So I think that's a complex area that we don't explore because people don't even often explore with themselves or tell anybody about it and are afraid of those things as opposed to understanding, we have complex brains and they play with us in our sexuality and everything else.
Do you see any patterns in the way different generations are dealing with sexuality?
Oh, I definitely do. I mean, I'm sometimes stunned by how young women are dressing these days. I would have thought they were streetwalkers, you know, if they'd done that when I was 25.
Those are called sex workers, by the way, Pepper.
Oh, sorry. Okay, sex workers. Sorry. Not PC here, but sex workers. Sorry. You're right. But what I would say is, so there's a certain more comfort these young women have with their bodies, of showing them and being proud of them and being sexy. But on the other hand, I worry that they sometimes don't know that the message they want to put out is the message that's received, and that may not make them safe by, you know, exhibiting that themselves very, very sexually in every environment. I just worry about their safety sometimes. I do.
Right.
Because I think there's still things up there. There's still sexism. There's still, predators. There's still people, even though most people, I think, are, you know, well-intentioned, there are people who are not. Mm-hmm. So sexuality can have some risk elements in it as well. But I do think that, you know, women do show their bodies a lot more, mm-hmm. and they do that because they can. And in my day, they couldn't. I mean, right. they really couldn't, whatever they wanted to do.
Yeah, I know. I've always, you know, wondered that, because women have certain restraints on how they're supposed to appear, but men, it's a little, you know, men walk around without their shirts all the time. You know, it's just completely accepted. So,
yeah, I mean, we don't have to go into too much about physiology to say why, but
yeah,
but you know, we have a very eroticized world, even though people don't want to admit that a lot of the time, mm-hmm. particularly when people are young and beautiful and feeling embodied, and I think good for them. Nonetheless, you know, there's a sexual energy being transmitted, and how we deal with it, you know, how much respect we give each person's right to say yes or no, whether it's male to male or female to female or female to male, mm-hmm. or whatever it is. These are very confusing images when, of course, we're built to be attracted to each other.
Mm-hmm. I look back on my life, and with my parents, it was something, I think we didn't talk about it. It was as though they thought it would never happen or exist. And then with my daughter, this next generation, I remember when she was about 11, she was interested. And so she got online and gave me a list of books she wanted me to order her. So I ordered her the books, and didn't necessarily talk a lot about it with her. But now I see parents now with younger children, and they seem like they're talking a lot more about it. So I think that's all moving in a really healthy direction.
I do too. I mean, acknowledging that, you know, as kids approach puberty, whether you like it or not, they're going to be interested in the changes in their body, and they're going to have crushes on somebody. Right. And the more guidance we give them, the more teachable moments we answer, the better off they are.
You've been doing research for a long time, and or studying research for sure. Is there any research findings that have kind of challenged assumptions that you had about people or sexuality?
Oh, yeah. I think we've learned a lot more about gender and, you know, the implications of kind of the fluidity of gender in many people. Mm-hmm. That's extremely challenging for people to deal with. There's been nothing more solid that people want to know than when there's a boy or a girl. You know, mm-hmm. you see a little baby, people say, is it a boy or a girl?
Right.
That's one of our fundamental beliefs. But in fact, it turns out, and this is relatively recent research in terms of, I think it's sophistication, that we may be on more of a spectrum than we thought. Mm-hmm. There's different ways of people to think of themselves, even in gender, much less sexuality. So that's been an interesting opening door for me that, you know, even though I knew some of this before, it's changed in terms of the research and people's open talk about, you know, where they feel fluid and when they feel fluid, and if they feel fluid, whereas many of us hold solidly onto our male or female identity. But it's a much more interesting question than it was before.
Yeah, and do you think that science will show that there's more physical components to that than we have
100%.
Thought before? Yeah,
I think there's lots of physical components, endocrine, brain, you know, things that we're just starting to get the tools to look at.
Right.
I think just because we haven't been able to find those physiological answers yet doesn't mean they're not there.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, in utero, we all start, right, as females. And then, so we all have the same equipment to begin with. And then it just shifts a bit, right?
Well, it shifts when you get a big load of androgens.
Right, yes.
And then there's androgen insensitivity, where even though you get those androgens, they don't have the same impact on you.
Right.
One of the interesting things to study is, you know, endocrine changes in while the fetus is forming, so that it may, in fact, change a lot about who we're attracted to, or our body parts, for that matter.
Right.
There's a lot of interesting things going on there that are, you know, a little bit too scholastic to talk about in depth here, but that matters.
So that kind of leads into a question I was going to say. Do you see a place that you would like to see more research going into? It sounds like that would be an area. Are there other areas?
I do want to know about the physiology of our sexual formation, and also, you know, the impact of the androgen system. And even I'd really like to know more about the brain and sexuality.
Right.
We've done very, you know, little research on that. We're more interested in the pituitary, you know, because we can measure, let's say, output of endocrine better. But I would like to know about that. I'm always curious that if we were totally free from culture, which of course we'll never be, what would our sexual dispositions be? And I do think I'd like to know a lot more, and this is a tougher thing, about how kids learn about their sexuality and how that education or lack thereof or certain kinds of things said to them matter. We're kind of restricted about these kinds of things for very young people. So it's sensitive, and I understand why it's sensitive, but I would like to know more about it.
I'm sure you've done so many lectures, you've been at, and you have lots of questions and answers. Is there a question that you get asked all the time that you wish people wouldn't ask you? And is there a question you wish that more people would ask you?
Well, let me refer a little bit to our last statement, because I really wish there was much more research on people's sexuality after 50, 60, 70, 80, 90. We just, I don't know if you know, they put together a professorship in my name, the Pepper Schwartz Professorship of Sexuality and Aging in the Family Medicine Department of the University of Minnesota. And the reason we raised that money was because there's so little conversation or research of people's sexuality after 50, but almost nothing after 65. And those people aren't dead. They have sexual lives. I would like to hear from them. So I suppose if you were going back to your last question about things I would hate, questions that I wish people wouldn't answer, where I can't tell you how many people will go up to someone who's, let's say, 80 and married or has a same-sex partner or whatever, but they're in a committed relationship, and they go like, well, do you guys still have sex?
Mm-hmm.
No, it's so disrespectful.
Yeah.
You know, would you say that to somebody else who's younger? No, it's almost like they think it's cute. So I guess that question is like, you know, don't treat people like they're cute, like you would like a five-year-old, on things that you're surprised that they might be doing and that might be intimate and might even be personal.
Yeah.
So there's that. That sometimes bothers me.
That kind of bothers me too, especially because, you know, the demographics on the planet, 65 and older is the fastest growing demographic. And these people are healthier, living longer, and hopefully having really good sex lives.
Yes. And then I think, and now you make me think of all the things I really would like to know more about. One of the others is I'd like to know why so many people turn off their sexual faucet. They really do. I'm often much more impressed, not by how much people are having sex, but how little they have it. What's interfering with their desire, their ability, their coldness to their partner, their loss of attraction to their partner? Because sometimes people think it's only single people not having sex. No, a lot of them are couples who haven't had sex in 10 years or have it once, you know, on New Year's Eve. It's a really important thing to me, because I know that a sexual life and well-being go together.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So, I do want to shift gears and talk about the TV show that you host. But before I do that, since we're talking about sex, give me a couple reasons why people should be having sex. Why is it good for you?
First of all, sex is good for your circulatory system.
Mm-hmm.
Second of all, you will sleep better. Third of all, you will, in fact, I have less cancer. Mm-hmm. It particularly for men, having a lot of ejaculations is related to lower prostate cancer. It will, in fact, have a full body impact on you that's positive. You will enjoy more of life because you'll have having these orgasms that create oxytocin, which is your well-being and sort of happiness drug that flows through you when you have an orgasm. So you have to also have orgasms as well as just have some kind of sex because the endocrine system doesn't respond as much unless you have orgasms. So there's really like a long list of things that, you know, from your mood to your body to your protection against disease to your ability to feel calmer enough to sleep, et cetera. All of these things are tied into having a sexual life.
One of my favorite things I ever heard was in your last lecture when you were talking about how men could, if they ejaculate 21 times a month, that they would reduce the risk of prostate cancer by 50%.
Yeah.
And some lady in the audience said, just let them die.
Yeah, that's great. I was like, write them that they can do this by masturbation.
You don't have to.
Sexual interaction, you know. It doesn't seem daunting to be responsible for that.
Hi, my name's Jillian Henderson, and I have been coming to Rancho La Puerta for about 10 years now. From the first time I arrived, it has absolutely been the most amazing experience and pretty much changed my life. So now whenever I'm feeling a little bit stressed or want to reset myself, I will come to the ranch and do that. And I love it so much that this time I actually decided to bring my children who are 26 and 28. And they too are having an amazing time. I just thought every year mom's going to this ranch thing, Rancho La Puerta, where is it, what is it? And now they understand and they get it. The most important things to me at the ranch are that I can do as much or as little as I want anytime. And I feel that I'm in this magical, amazing place where everything is like this wonderful, this vibe around me is just spectacular. I'm from Vancouver, Canada, and I already feel that nature and everything is in, like, I love it and it's with me at home. But here it's a completely different experience and wonderful. I just love it at the ranch.
I hope you're enjoying today's podcast as much as I am. To learn more about our wonderful presenters and exciting weeks coming up at the ranch, go to rancholaporta.com and check out our events calendar. Make sure to mention the podcast when making a reservation to take advantage of a special offer. Some restrictions may apply. I hope you're enjoying today's podcast as much as I am. To learn more about our wonderful presenters and exciting weeks coming up at the ranch, go to rancholaporta.com and check out our events calendar. Make sure to mention the podcast when making a reservation to take advantage of a special offer. Some restrictions may apply. Does long-term chemistry and compatibility, can they exist without one, exist without the other, or do you need both?
I think long-term chemistry helps you get by a whole lot of tough stuff.
Right.
You know, you could be pissed off at your partner, but if you have long-term chemistry with them, you can come back to them because eventually that attraction will pull you back. Chemistry is one of those difficult things to study. It's hard to understand, you know, why somebody might be drawn to someone chemically for a lifetime and for others it just goes away. Much of it could be dealt with in terms of loss of respect or illness or things like that. But when it's powerful, it helps your compatibility so much.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if you're drawn to somebody before you know them, and you find out there's no other compatibility there, you know, maybe your chemistry led you in the wrong direction.
Yeah. Chemistry is a kind of a magical thing. It's really hard to explain sometimes, but it's definitely exists, kind of like love, right?
Yeah. When you really know it, It's there, even though you may not know all the reasons why it exists.
Right.
It could be the expression in somebody's eyes. It could be the way they laugh. It could be that their ideal type, but I do mean that they're not your ideal type, but there's something about it. It just reaches into you and grabs you.
And now I forgot one more thing I did want to ask you about is, how do you think technology is affecting how we do intimate relationships? And I think the younger generation is maybe doing intimate relationships differently than we did.
Well, technology is a rugged world for relationships. As you know, I'm in a television show, Married at First Sight. So I get a lot of people who apply to get married by me and my two colleagues. We match them and they meet at the altar. And then we try to support these two strangers growing together and becoming a real couple and not having to get a divorce. And we get these young people, I'd say, let's say 25, 27, I'm going to call it young. They're burned out already. The technology has given them lots of partners and lots of outreach, but lots of bad experiences. People who have no responsibility to each other. They're not at the same high school. They didn't grow up together. They didn't go to college together. They didn't work in the office together. They don't owe each other anything unless they feel that inside. And they hurt each other. It becomes exhausting to people. So particularly because the age of marriage has moved back to 28 years old for college educated people, not much younger for others. And in the South, it's early, but for almost everywhere else, it's not. And so these people have had a lot of experiences and not all of it has helped them feel good about themselves.
And, but the show that you're on, Married at First Sight, it's in its, is it 18th season?
Well, in our 19th season, you're right. We did two for a lot while. We did two seasons a year, so it's 11 years, not 19 years. But it is kind of a unicorn that way.
So, and it seems that you don't have a lack of people wanting to get on the show. So, I feel like young people are a lot of young people still want to get married.
Absolutely, we get thousands of people per city. We've been in New York, Charlotte, New Orleans, Dallas, I mean, a lot of different kinds of places. And by the way, everyone says their city is the worst one to date in. Absolutely, 100%. Everybody says their city's the worst. How can they all be the worst? Because it's tough to do. So we do. We get thousands of people who say, please, in every city we go to.
What is the reason that the show has them not see each other before the altar?
Well, that's a good question. I think part of it is, you know, the drama of it, fair enough. But also I think we want people to want to be matched to someone who's committed to them. That's their main issue. And we also want them to be able to get to see this person's inner self and not turn off like, oh, that's not for me. You know, we try and pick people who are nice looking. Sometimes they're very good looking. But sometimes they're just nice looking and they might have passed this person on the street and not glanced at them. But there's things that we can discover because we're taking the time to get to know them beforehand that we think will be good for them. And we don't want that person to be dismissed out of hand.
Right.
And so it's a good reason not to see them before.
So what are some of the things you look for in a successful participant in the show?
I look for somebody who wants marriage, not dating, not sex, not just romance, but someone who wants a lifetime partner. They have their back and they have their back and to create a world together and maybe kids, but for sure this thing that is bigger than both of them. And I want that to be an intense desire.
Right.
I would say the second thing I care about is they have to be flexible. And not reactive. Flexible means, okay, they didn't get to pick this person out. They are going to be differences. How can they change their lives to accommodate each other?
Mm-hmm.
And not reactive, I would say, is somebody who's thin-skinned. I mean, you say one thing and they get angry, their identity gets questioned, et cetera. This is one of the things that is the most difficult with people. Thirdly, I want them to have not too specific a template. I mean, there are some people who need this person to be a certain kind of shoulders and a certain kind of miracle or certain kind of everything. And that kind of person, you know, maybe we hit it on the head by accident, but these people have never seen each other before. So we need somebody who could find a lot of people attractive by their smile, their eyes, their things like that. And I want someone who's kind, empathetic, someone who can understand somebody besides themselves. We all have a certain amount of narcissism. We need it to get ahead in life, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it can't be the overwhelming way you deal with someone else. You have to have some understanding of why you would want to please that person in their own terms and not just necessarily in your terms.
I feel like we all want that person that you just described.
Well, but
where is that person?
They are out there. I mean, that's the thing. People come to us, they say, I have been through it. I've seen them all. No one's out there like that. And I'm here to tell you they are out there. They're just, they may not have been in the package that you were, seeing on the street, but they're there.
Can you name a couple of things that people have to have in common for you to match them? Those are all characteristics you talked about, but there's got to be some certain things like religious backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, those kind of things.
They have to agree on children, whether they want them or not.
Mm-hmm.
They have to not just be sort of open to other races, but have shown that they've dated them, that that's actually either a preference or, have a lot of knowledge about them. We're not going to try somebody's first experiment with someone of a different race. That's an important thing. Religiosity is much more important than religion. Mm-hmm. How religious you are means a big deal. You could be different religions, no big deal, or you need to read the Bible every night together. I mean, those are really big differences.
Mm-hmm.
There are certain physical differences that are important. Height, for some people, I swear to God, hair color.
Mm-hmm.
There seems to be some prejudice against redheads.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why. It seems to me the silliest difference in the world. But if somebody has a deal breaker, we respect it.
Right.
That's that. I've had couples happen just recently, last season, where a woman said, no, I don't want anyone black. I like black people, but I'm not going to marry one.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens on the show, she falls in love with somebody else whose husband, who's black.
Right.
So sometimes people say one thing and their inner heart does another. So it's hard to know. But I think values are really important. I think these days political values are very important.
Mm-hmm.
People are really quite separate about that. I think it'd be very hard to put couples who were very far right and very far left together. I wouldn't do it.
Yeah, yeah.
What else do I think? I think people should be sort of going in the same direction.
Yeah.
What kind of life do they want?
Mm-hmm.
And we try and put that together. If somebody lives to travel and somebody lives to be at home, that's just not a good one, right?
Right. Well, how does finances affect that? The putting them people together?
Well, money helps a lot of problems. You can buy yourself out of some certain anxieties, for example. Not worrying about the rent every month is a really good thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think people have a range, though. If somebody has everything else they want, sometimes those economics are not as important as you might think.
Mm-hmm.
I think education is actually more important than a very specific amount of money.
Right. Yeah.
However, if you need somebody wealthy and you say absolutely nothing but that, we're going to respect that.
Right. So how many couples do you put together per season? Is it just one?
Five.
You put five couples together per season?
Yeah, and they're followed by a crew. So they have five crews that kind of live with them, except during sleep hours. They have a lot of filming.
Wow. So, and what's the success rate been over the years?
I'd say it's about, it depends what you think of as success. I have two measures.
Okay.
And I'm not just trying to be,
I want to hear. I want to hear your two measures.
Okay, what is if they're still together after 5 years? And
wow,
I'd say about 20% of them are, and we've got 16 babies that are on the ground. So families, we create families. Wow. But the other thing I would say, and I think we're at the 90% rate there, which is, are you glad you did this? Are you a better person for it?
Mm-hmm.
Would you be a better partner in the future?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, at a very high rate, they say, yes, I would do it again. I got a lot out of it. I'm a better person for a marriage in the future. And a lot of the people that didn't end up married contact us later and say, just that. Thank you for helping me get to this point myself. I mean, we're not perfect. We don't always put together a match that once we take the layers of the onion off that, you know, we would have done it again with those two people. But we do find some people that belong together, and we do help most people.
So on that wedding day, when they show up to see each other for the first time, have there been times when it was just immediate, no way?
Yes. Mm-hmm. One of those from the very first season, after she said yes, she did say yes. And then she went and cried in the corner and said, the experts have let me down. And that hurt a lot because I was her expert. Uh-huh. But over time, they fell in love and they have four children.
Oh, my gosh.
So they're fine. You know, it was a rough start. Then we had something that's never happened before, and I hope it'll never happen again. We had one woman go up to the, you know, and they signed all kinds of things that they'll at least give this a shot. And she went up to the altar, took one look, and walked out.
Yeah.
And that was horrible. We actually, which is not usual, were able to match him with somebody else. But we had to ask him and her if they would be willing to do this again. And they did. And they didn't end up married, but they did care a lot about each other, and they were a good match. I think in that case, we didn't know that their future lifestyles would be so different. You know, one wanted to sort of live in a farm and, you know, adopt animals, and the other was a city guy, you know, and they ultimately they weren't hitting on the same path. If we'd known more about that, we wouldn't have done it.
And for being on this show for 19 seasons now, it sounds exhausting, but has it changed your views on relationships at all and marriage?
100%. I mean, that's funny. I've done all this research, but I really didn't understand how much people get in their own way and defeat themselves, say they want something and truly want it and still do everything they're used to doing to defeat the possibility of this thing going forward. I don't think I understood how powerful that was. That's probably the biggest thing I found out. And also the ways they do it, you know, and how much fear people carry with them. So much of the behavior people do to undermine themselves comes from fear-based stuff. Going and rejected. This isn't right for me. The glass is half full as opposed to glass is half empty. Just a lot of fear-based behaviors that I hadn't taken into account in the way I should.
Yeah. So if someone's listening to this, a couple, let's say a couple that's not on your show, what advice? Because I mean, having expert people study you, understand who you are, study the other person, and put them together, kind of gives you a head. You know, you're a running start. So, what advice would you give someone who's not on your show, who's thinking about getting married? You know, like I've heard people say before, if you're dating someone by the third date, you need to introduce them to people that know and love you, because they're going to see things you don't see.
Well, I think I would wait more than the third date. Okay. I mean, the fact is you can learn a lot about your marriage and you can correct a lot about your marriage. And you could have insight about yourselves by watching this show. I mean, it sounds a bit self-serving, but I have had a lot of couples say, you know, we've learned a lot just by watching it. In fact, I swear this is true. Yesterday, I got an email from some people who invited me to their wedding who met watching the show in some kind of group that was watching the show and were drawn to each other and learned a lot about how they each react to what is going on in front of them. Right. And they feel that that played a great deal of what their attraction and ultimate commitment was to them. So I do think we can help people who aren't on the show.
I was looking at research on marriage too. And in the United States, currently 45% of first marriages fail, 60% of second marriages fail, and 70% of third marriages fail. And I would think the opposite. I would think that we would learn a little if we chose to keep doing it. Why do you think that statistic is the way it is?
Some people don't learn. You know, they just do the same thing that they did before. And the thing that defeated the first marriage is there to defeat the second.
Right.
And I've not seen the statistics on third, but I actually wonder about that because I met so many people who honestly, their third marriage was it. That was the one that worked. Maybe just because they gave up on some of this stuff. They got older. Right, I think yeah. I might think to look at third. I think if the sociologist wants to separate people who marry in their 60s versus people who remarry in their 30s, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
And there's other kinds of variables I'd want to know explain it. But I do think that if you remarry and you don't think there's anything else you have to learn and it was just all the other person, that's a bad sign.
That is a bad sign because you're the common denominator. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. You want to see what is it that you contribute, not blame right. yourself, but contribute to something that didn't right. work, that could work if you change things.
Right. I also read recently too that the 30%, 33%, that's a third of the younger generation it will not marry. It's not a value that they hold any longer. So that's an interesting shift as well. So the people that come on your show really want to get married, but they're right. not in that 33%.
But they're tired of meeting that 33%.
Yes.
Exactly.
That's a good point.
They're wasting their time.
Yes.
You know, they want somebody who actually wants commitment as opposed to, you know, a fun time or even a romantic and intimate time, but not a commitment for life. They want to find right. that person.
Okay, and I'm just going to say something for my myself. I think that you can have a commitment with that without marriage. So,
of course, you can. It just helps a little bit to sort of frame it right. in other people's life because yes. you know what's interesting is how people look at you and how they build you up as a couple. And if you want to have a couple identity from people who only recognize it as marriage. You know, sometimes you have to educate them, like, this is my person. We're just as committed as anybody else. And there's right. reasons we don't get married. But, you know, give us the right. support yeah. we need because yeah. we are a couple.
Well, I could actually talk to you all day long because I have 6 pages of notes. But I think that I'm making this the longest podcast ever. So I want to tell you that I really appreciate you spending this time with me today. And it was fascinating. It's always fascinating to me. You know me, I love to talk about sex and relationships. So, and I hope that at 80, you continue doing the work that you're doing because people need it.
Oh, thank you, Gary. I appreciate that. And I have no intention of stopping.
Okay, good, good. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you. That was great. Appreciate it.
I always enjoy my conversations with Pepper, and today was no exception. We are all interested in relationships and sex, and Pepper is a wealth of information and experience on both of those subjects. I also love how open she is to discussing different opinions and beliefs surrounding relationships and sex. One of my favorite things I learned today is it was Pepper's 11-year-old friend in her neighborhood that she started at age 11 giving sexual advice to or studying and learning. I love even more that her mom was willing to start a little neighborhood group for girls who had questions. Pepper has dedicated her life to educating people and ultimately bringing them joy, self-acceptance, and love. At age 80, she believes we need to start doing more research and talking about older people and how they are having healthy sex lives and can continue to have healthy sex lives. She shared why sex is beneficial to our health, our well-being, and our longevity. In the future, Pepper would like to see more research around gender and the science and philosophy and what it can teach us about gender. One of my takeaways today is that relationships and sex are a part of this human experience and can bring us much joy. And with that, I'm wishing you much joy and health. I'll see you next time.